Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 22, The Best Comics You've Never Heard Of.
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
We wanted to take an episode here to talk about some of our favorite characters and series and miniseries that we think are largely unknown or maybe just underread. Things you may not have heard of, or at least may not know a lot about, and probably haven't read, but that we think are worth tracking down.
Yeah, the episode so far where we've talked about a specific character or a specific issue or miniseries, they've been slightly more well-known. The exception to that is probably White Tiger, which was a fairly obscure character and an obscure miniseries. But aside from that, we've talked about the first appearance of Batman and Flash of Two Earths and what if stories.
What if Elektra story. So we've talked about some pretty
famous.
We've talked about some of the more popular, well-known stories. Here we wanted to talk about, again, some ones that might be a little more on the obscure side. And the nice thing is these days, we don't really have to worry about, well, has this book been traded? Is it in the back issue bins? Because between eBay and torrents, You can probably find most of the books that we're going to mention.
You can
one way or another
read most of the books. Now, Actually finding physical copies might be a little difficult.
Yeah, some are pretty obscure independent books.
Very
some are
small print runs and
right.
Very few of those sold. So,
I've been thinking about that White Tiger trade that we talked about, and I really like that story. I'm trying to figure out why it didn't sell. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is, it's a pretty obscure character, and I think, as much as we praised the author, if you remember, Tamara Pierce, she was primarily a young adult writer.
True.
And so, when we saw that name on the title, it meant, oh, this is a writer we know. But many other people would look at that name and say, this is a writer I've never heard of.
Oh, she writes young adult books. That's going to be crap.
Or, this is a writer I've never heard of.
True.
With a character I've barely heard of. So I think in retrospect, you can see that combination.
And as we talked about, like, it's not even really a superhero story in the same sense. It's mostly about organized crime, and it's more of like a police and detective-y sort of story.
It's definitely a street-level story.
Yeah, there's a decent amount of fighting, but even a lot of that is about tracking people and following business deals and stuff like that.
And it's about family dynamics and there's some of those aspects in it as well.
Not as much punchy fight.
Again, we're big fans of it. I think you'll see as we go through this list that White Tiger may actually be the most mainstream superhero of our bunch here.
Oh yeah.
So we are going to go a little obscure here, I think.
We're going
on some of these.
We are going indie comics deep cut. It's going to be.
So I did want to start with just a couple of sort of honorable mentions in terms of less well-known books. And I say honorable mention because they're things that I've mentioned before.
Yes.
Either on this show or other shows. One is I just absolutely love the John Sable Freelance series by Mike Grell. I believe it was 56 or 58 issues. He wrote them all and he drew the first 44 or so of the issues. Those are great. I have talked about those in episodes 3 and episodes 8 of the Quarterman podcast I've covered. Big fan of that. I think because of Mike Grell's notoriety, you know, against some people, that may be among the less obscure of these sort of obscure independent books. One that I think is very obscure, very independent, from the 80s was a series I talked about on Back to the Bins, episode 141, my first appearance there. And that is the title The Maze Agency. And that's a sort of fair play mystery series. So again, not a traditional superhero story. And I do think that, generally speaking, as we've seen in the New 52, superheroes sell and other things tend to not sell quite as much.
Yeah.
And so we'll talk about an example or two within that. So as much as we say comics is a medium, not a genre, superheroes are the genre, superheroes are definitely the dominant genre in comic books. I think
yes.
There's no way around that, and I don't think we mind that.
No.
I do wish there was room for some of these other things to be a little more popular, though.
Yeah, it would be nice if one of my favorite series right now, All-Star Western, was actually a Western comic. That would be refreshing. And it hasn't really been since, like, issue 15, but...
It's actually been pretty good recently, I hear.
It's been good. It's been very good, but it's been a superhero comic. And I'm like, that's cool. But I, you know, it was a good Western comic, and it is now a good superhero comic. It's still good. It's just a different genre now. And I kind of wish that I still had a good Western comic that I could recommend to people.
Right. So in terms of specific ones that we wanted to bring to the table, you've got the first one, Emily.
Yes. We have a couple other sort of, we'd say are sort of backup stories that you probably haven't heard of, but should absolutely find if at all humanly possible. This was a miniseries from the 80s and is actually, I'm pretty sure, the first comic that I ever read at about the age of 5 that my dad tossed me. A little 4-issue mini called Sword of the Atom. And it's the story of Ray Palmer having some relationship difficulties with his wife, but rather than dealing with his family drama, he decides to run off to the Amazon to investigate some sciencey thing.
Okay, now when you were 5, 6, or 7, that was not the main part of the story that I wanted you to imbibe and understand.
No, but as a 20-year-old, there are other things that I picked up. He runs away to the jungle, where he tries to find a white dwarf star which powers his belt and powers, ends up getting zapped and stuck at about 6 inches tall, basically trapped without his powers. And at this size, he explores the dangers of the jungle and ends up discovering a secret city of these small aliens that live in this pseudo-medieval, vaguely feudalistic, medieval-ish society. And becomes first an outcast, then a rebel, then a hero, and has to fight in gladiatorial combat.
And by hero, you mean ride a frog.
Yes, he rides a frog. Off into the sunset with a yellow-skinned bikini babe. It was the 80s.
To be fair, it's not a bad way to end a book, series, life.
Well,
destiny.
That's issue 3 of 4.
Oh!
Issue 4 goes back to the family drama and his difficulties with his wife, Jean Loring.
I understand they work those things out, though, in the next 20 years.
Yeah, it would take a while, but, you know, eventually, in following miniseries, they got a divorce. They each moved on with their lives, which I really think is best for both of them to just separate and just never see each other again. Yeah.
Sounds like a happy ending.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. He got a hot, yellow-skinned bikini babe. Ray Palmer's life was awesome.
Now, people will know that over on the Quarterbin podcast, I wrapped up recently a 3-issue Adam Strange miniseries where Adam gets pulled back and forth from Earth to Ran. He has a family there. He cheats on his wife, and things go badly from there.
You left out the most important part. Pregnant. Pregnant wife.
I may have mentioned that once or twice, emphatically, during one or two of the episodes. At least in the Adam story that you mentioned, it points out their marital difficulties.
Indeed.
And so the yellow-skinned alien babe, it's not quite as out of nowhere.
Exactly. And it actually, it starts out with Ray waiting for Jean to come home. She's been working late hours, and he goes and sees a car pull in, goes and looks, and Jean is making out with this guy from the office, and they have these fights about, oh, I've been trying, you haven't been here, Jean. Well, when you're here, you're not Ray, you're the Atom. I didn't marry the Atom. I want time for us. But you get the sense that there is some legitimate issues that really, really need to be worked out in this relationship.
Now, like I said, when I gave this to you to read when you were 6 or 7, it was because of the frog riding and the medieval feudalist fantasy setting.
And the sword fights, and there's gladiatorial combat, and the evil vizier who's controlling the king, and rebels.
I had sort of forgotten about the emotional issues inside the Palmer marriage.
And this is why it's such a great story, because you can read this at the age of 5 or 7 or 10, and it's like, oh, sweet, cool action stuff. Wow, this is really sad that he and his wife don't get along, but oh, this lady's really nice and she's cool, and oh well, at least his wife is trying to find him, at least she thinks he's dead, and so I don't feel that bad, etc., etc. And then you're mostly focused on the sword fights and the frog riding. But then when you're 25 or 35 or 45, it's actually a pretty in-depth and meaningful look at marriage problems and how they're dealing with this issue. You know, Gene does think that Ray dies in his accident when he gets zapped. And so she mourns for a pretty substantial period of time. The whole series takes place over the course of like 6 months or something. And so she does legitimately mourn and she's very sad. But then she's like, well, I'm going to move on with my life because he's dead. Let's just go on with this. And then she starts to think, well, maybe he isn't dead. And then she starts to feel bad and goes to find him. And I'm like, these are the actions of actual reasonable human beings. You know, she doesn't seem like some crazy psychopath.
What I like about this story is that it attempts, again, in the 1980s version, to modernize and figure out something to do with the Atom.
Yes.
Problem is, you know, the Golden Age Atom's just a short guy who packs a punch. He's small but powerful, so we'll call him the Atom. And then, you know, the Silver Age version had this ability to shrink. And that is such a science fiction cliche of mm-hmm. that era.
He's very Adam Strange-y. Like,
yeah, I think there is you know, some interesting parallels
instead
there.
Instead of backpack and gun, he's got a belt and a super suit. Like,
and there's not a lot to really do with that power, it turns out.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent we might be proven wrong in the Ant-Man movie.
Yeah.
They might be able to figure out a way to make that power a much more dynamic thing.
Yeah. But and something that they focus a lot is that not just his size changing, but that he can shift his mass. So when he's full-sized, he can drop his mass and fly, basically. That he can float. Or even when he's tiny, he can increase the mass of his fist and punch someone with the weight of a full-sized guy, even though he's 3.5 inches tall. Like, there's some interest. It's like, okay, yeah, that is actually sort of useful. That's basically what this miniseries and the following couple of miniseries and specials were basically like, please pay attention to the Atom. He's super cool. He's actually useful. But
they did have to pull him out of the general DCU and toss him into this sort of fantasy world.
Right.
To attempt to find a place where he could fit in modern day. Modern day being the 1980s in which the book was written.
Yeah, and it didn't work out that well. We wouldn't see much of the Atom for a couple decades, really.
And in the lead up into the New 52 and in the New 52, they've tried to put other characters with that similar power set. And my impression is that none of that has really caught on.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate, but it is an excellent miniseries. It's got a lot of drama, action, a little tiny bit of comedy here and there, but overall, it's a really good series. And if you can find it, you should check it out.
And like you said, they did a Sword of the Atom miniseries, a 4-issue. And then they may have done 2 of them and then some specials as well. So it's not just one miniseries.
Yeah,
there were some follow-ups to it.
Yeah, the whole run, quote-unquote, is I think about 11 issues. Like a 4-issue mini, 3 standalones, and a 4-issue, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Because the first one I wanted to talk about is sort of similar in the sense that I cheated. That's actually 2. It's 1 and it's sequel, and it's the Nathaniel Dusk 2 4-issue miniseries. Again, we're both picking minis here. And this was sort of a noirish detective story. I like those detective stories. I mentioned The Maze Agency, and to some extent John Sable has sort of that aspect of spy/mystery/thriller/suspense character. So I really like the Nathaniel Dusk private investigator stories. So I would recommend those 2. And I believe I have seen those in our cheap bins. I think I've seen some of the Sword of the Atoms as well in the cheap bins. So those, if you look, both of those were put out by DC.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of obscurity, they don't really fit the obscure, like, so it's not that you didn't have a chance to find them. It's just that they were under-purchased.
Yeah, and overlooked.
So I think, you know, we were trying to avoid saying that these are underrated series,
right.
And I don't think we've used that term here. I think we're sort of at underread, we think, or underappreciated or underread.
Or just not noticed.
Yeah. I do think some of these miniseries from the 80s and early 90s did sort of, I mean, they do come and go quickly, three months or 4 months, and sort of if you miss them or aren't paying attention, they can go right by, and some of them were very good.
My next choice is a little complicated. I am a big fan of Demon Knights. I love the Demon Knights. It is amazing.
By is, you mean was.
Shush.
In your mind, they're still being published, they're still being collected, and one day...
I can read them today, and they are there, and shut up. Yeah, it was canceled. Made me really, really sad when that
Along
happened.
Along with All-Star Western, by far our two favorite New 52 books.
God, they're amazing.
And I do think that fits the criteria of underread.
Yeah.
By definition. We looked at the sales figures.
That's the thing is, by definition, you didn't read this because in the entirety of planet Earth, only about 14,000 people were reading it. One of them was me.
One of them was me.
I loved the series while it was going on, and I thought they were just great stories. Loved the ability to get my fantasy kick in comics. And by far my favorite character out of the Demon Knights was this wonderfully bizarre character called the Shining Knight. This character fits so well with the rest of this team in this Arthurian and action-oriented series. I was like, oh, wow, okay, so they brought together all of these other relatively unknown fantasy characters and created a brand new character in Shining Knight. That's awesome. Only about a week ago did I Google this and realize that the Shining Knight has been around since 1940. Now, originally, Shining Knight was just a typical fantasy character and was famously part of the Seven Soldiers of Victory, which featured Star-Spangled Kid, Stripesy, Green Arrow, Speedy, and we talked about them a little bit in a previous episode. But the character was reinvented and sort of rediscovered and brought back into the public eye when he was retooled and rebooted and put in a new series that was headed by Grant Morrison. It's weird.
Isn't that a bit redundant?
Yeah, like, really weird. And I recently picked up the Shining Knight miniseries, not paying attention to who the author was, but I grabbed it out of a bin, there was the entire thing put together, and I was like, oh, I really love Shining Knight, maybe this will tell me where this character came from, that would be awesome. And I read the first issue of the miniseries and was incredibly confused. I thought, okay, I must have missed something. Maybe I grabbed issue 4, not issue 1, and I laid all 4 issues out. I was like, nope, this is number 1. And then I looked at the cover and was, oh, Grant Morrison. Okay, this isn't going to make any sense.
That explains the weird, nonsensical nature of the lack of coherence in the storytelling.
Yes. I'm not saying it's bad. It is interesting. But that's about the best I can say. I personally really enjoyed it, and I found out that this was the root of something that made Shining Knight an interesting character to me in Demon Knights, that this was the root of Shining Knight being a woman, maybe. That in Demon Knights, there's a lot of ambiguity about what Yistin's gender actually is. And in the Grant Morrison mini, he made it that Justin was a girl pretending to be a squire who was then knighted by the Knights of Camelot and then thrown around through time, thus ending up in the miniseries. So it was very interesting, but not really a story. Now, After I finished reading it, I went and did a little bit more Google work and realized that my feeling that I have definitely missed something, yeah, I was right. The Shining Knight miniseries was part of Grant Morrison's build-up to the new Seven Soldiers of Victory, just called Seven Soldiers, usually. And so there was this whole thing about an alien invasion that was cyclically coming and culling humanity every 5,000 to 12,000 years, and Camelot was the previous culling, and so Yestin's Camelot was from 10,000 years ago, not 500 years ago, and then the aliens were actually detectives, and there was a schizophrenia monster.
Okay, that makes sense.
Grant Morrison happened. So
he sort of got little old Doom Patrol on it.
Yes, it is very Doom Patrol. So if you like Doom Patrol, you should absolutely pick this up, because it is so up your alley, and it is really interesting. But I felt it didn't really qualify, since I couldn't say that it was good, and I couldn't even say if it was unread, because it's Grant Morrison. I'm assuming a lot of people have at least heard of what he was doing, even if they haven't read it. So my verdict is confused. But so, Michael Leyland should definitely check it out.
That's Grant Morrison. I'm sure he has.
Yeah, he probably has. Michael, what do you think?
So you've got Demon Knights and the Seven Soldiers, specifically the Shining Knight miniseries.
Yes. So both of those sort of in combination are my underreads. If you can pick it up, the first 8 issues in particular of Demon Knights are awesome. In issue 9, they start like the big building arc that would go for the rest of the series up until it was canceled. So if you don't necessarily want to get totally invested through issue like 22, the first 8 wrap up pretty neatly, and they've got a lot of good comedy and action and monsters and horses and fire, dragons, demons, it's all good.
Yeah, I agree. I think the first 2 trades are the ones that Paul Cornell wrote.
Yes.
And I think those are terrific.
Yes, they are by far the best issues of the series, and the rest of it's pretty good too.
Before we get totally obscure with our list, let's take a break, play a few quick promos, and then we'll be back to talk about more comics you may not have read.
You know, a dear friend once said to me, it's a lot of fun when everyone's a dork of some sort or another. And I thought not only are those words to live by, it's an idea worth celebrating. So that's why I created Pop Culture Affidavit, a podcast that is about, well, let's just say it's completely random. One episode might be about movies, the next might be about comics, the next might be about music. All that matters is that I'm giving you a recap and critique of stuff I enjoy, and you're having as much fun as I am, or at least I hope. So join me, Tom Paneris, for Pop Culture Affidavit, the sworn testimony of a dork. You can find a new episode at least once a month at popcultureaffidavit.podomatic.com, and notes, essays, and other stuff once a week at popcultureaffidavit.com.
It started in November 2010, when one guy decided it was time to show the denizens of the internet that there was more to Superman's adventures from the 70s and early 80s than Alan Moore and Kryptonite Nevermore. Now, 3.5 years later, that mission continues. This is Superman. In the Bronze Age. My name is Charlie Niemeyer, and every week I shine the spotlight on this long overlooked era on Superman in the Bronze Age. Join in the fun at www.supermaninthebronzeage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
And we're back.
So far we've actually managed to hit, if you count White Tiger as a Marvel, and then all the other ones we've mentioned have been DC's, now we start to get independent and a little more legitimately obscure. So others of mine come from this same general era of the mid to late 80s, early 90s. I was very willing at this point to try new independent books from publishers like Pacific and First Comics and Eclipse and Comico. So my next one is called Baker Street, written and drawn by Guy Davis. This is a 10-issue black and white series, covers two arcs, and it's basically a modern retelling of Sherlock Holmes stories. The gist of it is that the Sherlock character is a female former cop now in the London punk scene of the 70s and 80s, which is where these stories take place. And our Watson character is an American exchange student who ends up rooming with our Holmes character, whose name's Sharon, in this. And the world that they build is a world where the Victorian era never actually ended. And World War II never actually happened, I believe, is also part of the world building. So London never went through the Blitz is part of it. So you have all of those old buildings still standing. You have Victorian dress and some Victorian ethics. And that is what the punk scene is rebelling against.
Okay.
So there is a vaguely steampunk aspect to it without the technology, but at least some of the atmosphere of steampunk. And that's a look that I'm still a fan of. I know it's, I think steampunk may be somewhat on the decline because the steampunk is still an aesthetic that I like still to this day. And I guess technically this, again, would not fit neatly in that category, but I'm a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes. So anything that has that Victorian aspect to it. And to me, one of the great things about the Sherlock Holmes characters, the Holmes and Watson relationship, is that no matter where you put it, if you modernize it and keep them as Watson and Holmes on TV, if you keep them in their right era and make it a Robert Downey Jr. action movie, that can still work. There's a current book called Watson and Holmes, which puts the characters in modern day as African-Americans in Harlem. And as long as you do the relationship right and tell a good mystery, the backbone of the Watson-Holmes story and relationship is strong enough to carry. And that's what you have in this series, Baker Street, where it's put in a different time, in a different context, but in the backbone of that relationship and a Holmes-like character and a Watson-like character work in many, many settings. So I highly recommend Baker Street. You know, it's a black and white, ran 10 issues, two separate arcs. They have been traded. Possible that you could find those, but of course you can eBay and various other means. Even these obscure books that we're talking about can probably be found.
And it is nice to know that there is a black and white indie series that's good, because I think sometimes when you combine both black and white and indie, that sort of conjures up concepts of cheap, unprofessional, lazy, sloppy, and it is good to know that there are at least some trades and some books that you shouldn't be turned off just because it's black and white.
I'm not a fan of black and white in general. This is in terms of comics. I'm not even a big fan of the Showcase. Even of artists that I really like, there's just something to me about comic books that should be four color action.
Yeah.
And this is about the only exception that I can come up with of a story that really works well in the black and white setting.
Well, we now move to our actual top runner final picks of this little ranking that we had going on here. You talked about a steampunk-ish book. I chose a straight-up steampunk comic. It is Neil Gaiman's Mr. Hero, The New Matic Man, N-E-W. I freaking love this series. This is one from Techno Comics that you picked up back in the day and just sort of hung on to. Never really mentioned it to me, never tossed it my way. You know, it was just sort of sitting there. And
that's because there weren't any marital strife and dramatic relationship breakdowns, which is what I evidently foisted upon you when you were 5, 6, and 7. That seems to be all that I gave you. Is that what you're saying?
Basically. I found this one while we were poking through your long boxes a year or two ago, when I was really getting back into comics, when I was regularly going and picking up new 52 books and bringing those home, and we were reading those, and I just wanted to go back and be like, okay, well, was there anything else that you have? Oh, maybe I'll pick up some of these Iron Mans that you've got. Maybe I'll pick up some of these, like, Luke Cage and Hero for Hire. Yeah, that sounds cool. Maybe I'll grab a couple of those. And then I found all of these really crazy, over-the-top, super-saturated covers that had, like, lizard faces on them and robots wearing top hats. And I was like, okay, you have my attention. I picked them up and gave them a read-through, and I'm pretty sure I read all 18 issues in about 5 hours, starting at about 9 p.m. That was one of those comic reading moments that I kind of regret because, spoiler, there's a downer ending. And yeah. Reading that at 2:10 in the morning when I was tired and barely coherent was probably not the best of ideas. But it is a fantastic story.
Now, let me mention a couple things. Emily's going to talk about some of the details in it. But just not to engage in total...
Shameless self-promotion. Shameless,
total shameless self-promotion. I did cover on the Quarterbin podcast, episode 23, a sister comic to this. Another book by Techno Comics from the mid-90s. Leonard Nimoy's Primordials. And as I talked about in that episode, part of the Techno Comics business plan was to contract with famous authors and celebrities some of their ideas. So the Primordials book is based on concepts and ideas from Leonard Nimoy and Isaac Asimov, and this one is based on concepts from Neil Gaiman. To clarify, Mr. Spock did not write the comics that I talked about on Quarterbin, and Neil Gaiman did not write the scripts for the Mr. Hero book.
No.
To use the movie production analogy, Neil Gaiman would be an executive producer of this.
Rather than the direct scripter.
Rather than the scriptwriter.
No, that honor goes to James Vance, who wrote the first 16 issues. And I adore this because, I've said it before, I will say it again, I am a proudly self-proclaimed steampunk. I love steampunk, and something that I love about it is actually steampunk literature, which not many people talk about. Mostly people talk about the dress and the costume and the customs and the technology. Sometimes music will occasionally seep in there, but not many people talk about steampunk lit as a thing, and I personally love it, and this is a great example, in my opinion. Basic story is that our lady protagonist is rooting around in this old abandoned opera house and finds a robot that's made out of brass. Turns out the robot is not technically from the past, it's from the past and space, and was sent through this portal to Earth as part of a plot to take over the world. And this evil extra-dimensional force that concocted this scheme is a major player both in this story and several of the other Techno Comics stories and series. It is the Technophage, who is basically a steampunk himself, but evil, and has modeled his entire world around Victorian London because there is no better expression of squalor and depression than the early dawn of the Industrial Revolution.
And to be fair, the Ripper murders do tend to lead into that conclusion.
Yeah, that is our sort of big, grand overarching scope and fight against this evil technophage who's trying to destroy the infinite multiverse. But the story itself focuses on the relationship between our lady protagonist and this robot who has been damaged in order to no longer be connected to this great evil robot network.
Did you mention that the robot had a mustache?
The robot does have a mustache because it landed in Victorian London on Earth, and the guy who found it decided, this thing looks too imposing. I'm going to put a mustache on it and give him a top hat to wear because Victorian London.
And robots.
And robots, which are two of the greatest things that go amazingly together. So a lot of the stories focus around Jenny and the robot, Mr. Hero, trying to figure out how to fight the phage, how to get to him. They meet up with this wandering wise man who helps them travel to different planets about halfway through, and it turns into this sort of jumping quest to figure out where Mr. Hero came from, what happened in the past, how they can fight the technophage. As I said, spoiler alert, it doesn't have a very happy ending, but it is an excellent story. It has a lot of really pretty deep themes about consumerism and culture and, you know, gluttony, but actually a lot of sort of religious subtones and a lot of Adam and Eve metaphors and things like that, which I actually thought were pretty interesting and very well handled. Just lots of questions about innocence and knowledge, and if you search for the technophage, you will learn of the technophage, and just the act of searching will destroy you in some sense. Not to say that it's all heavy, because issues 9 and 10, I think, deal with Mr. Hero and Jenny fighting stereotypical Liefeldian heroes. I kid you not.
And remember, this book is 95-96.
It is a direct, at-the-time jab at Liefeldian character creation. It's Blood Boil and Boom Bolts or something, and they are designed like every Liefeld character ever, with giant muscles and big capes and growling, and it is freaking hilarious. The two villains buy Image, quote-unquote, comics, and model themselves after that. And it's just hysterical, because then you've got a couple of issues of these two idiots, dressed like idiots, fighting a robot in a top hat and tuxedo with a mustache, as a ginger yells from the background in, like, a New York accent, and it is just fantastic.
What could be better than that?
Dinosaurs. No. Oh, wait, it has those.
Yeah, I forgot about the dinosaurs.
Best series that you've never heard of.
And we liked this one so much that when we decided a couple years ago to experiment with the process of binding some of our comics, this was the series that we decided to go with. I don't know if there are any trades. I don't know if you can find the issues. But we have a bound Vagrant Killing version of the book.
Oh! I've got to pick up the slack since Andy Leyland's out of Omnibuy.
How did the binding turn out, would you say?
It is pretty excellent. When you do binding, there's a sort of a simple packet and a slightly more advanced setup that you can get. The simplest version, they just take it and basically glue the issues in and then stick it in a cover and send it back to you with a little bit of print on it so you know what it is. We stepped it up a couple of notches. We got it actually sewn in, so the actual quality of the binding is really nice. The comics lay really flat, so it's actually really easy to read them, which was my biggest concern.
You have some issues on some of the gutters. That's yes. One thing where you lose the very edges of the comics.
The inside gutters, you lose just a little bit.
You could lose maybe a 16th of an inch.
Yeah.
And very rarely you lose a letter of the lettering, perhaps, but
yeah, but
that is very few and far between.
Yeah, they did a really good job of making sure that you weren't going to lose very much of the art or almost any of the dialogue, so that's quite good. We also went up a couple of steps because since it is a very steampunk book, we decided to go in and get little end papers and sent in special instructions for the way it was supposed to be bound, separated out the covers. Like, we went all out on this one. But there were plenty of options to do that, of saying, that you wanted certain pages inserted, or if you wanted to have end papers included and you sent those in, they would add those. And it was a pretty awesome experience. And I've now got a gorgeous hardcover volume that I will have on my shelf for years to come.
And we will put some pictures of the bound book, a couple pictures of that, on the website, either maybe as a separate post from the episode posting. But we'll include some of that. Because for me, when we were considering that process, part of the issue for me was, show me some pictures of what the finished product is actually going to look like.
Right.
So I think one thing we've learned in this discussion is that even though you consider yourself an advocate of steampunk comics and literature, etc., I was actually a steampunk before you were.
It's true.
So there. And you don't think I'm a cool dad.
Aw, you are a cool dad.
Aw, thanks.
But you're still a dad.
What? That sounded like an insult. I'm not sure. Now, my number one choice, or my winner for an underread book that I would recommend you search out, is one, I believe we've mentioned it before, and we're sort of trying to figure out a place or an excuse to talk about it more in detail at some point, and that is Evangeline by Chuck Dixon. This is a book that produced about 15 issues over three different comic companies, because that's what the independent comic book scene in the late 80s, mid to late 80s was. Matter of fact, it published those, I think it's a total of 15 issues, over something like 5 years.
Ooh.
So again, you can do the math on it started with Comico, and I don't know if they went out of business or canceled it, and it picked up one or two issues somewhere else, and then sort of finished its run at First Comics is where it ended up.
Oh, really?
So it's awesome. So it's one of those very disconnected series as you were attempting to read it at the time. But I really enjoyed it. The main character is Evangeline, a former nun slash vigilante slash assassin. And actually, as I say former nun, I believe she's actually still a nun at the time. So again, this concept that we've talked about before of religion in future, and it's a futuristic book. So this idea of religion slash future slash comics slash is a really interesting one. And I think Evangeline is, to me, almost exhibit A in how to do that in a really interesting sort of way.
Yeah, there's a topic in there somewhere. It's just finding it right now is the problem.
I don't know. I can't remember if she's the Pope's personal assassin but something to that
nice.
Extent. You know, she's carrying out, you know, as an obedient nun, carrying out the orders of her order, which 23rd century are not just helping the poor, but there's some other activities involved as well. But I sort of felt that could be a parody. If you mention that, you know, sexy vigilante nun assassin for the Pope.
I was going to say, you say nun with a shotgun. People are like, okay, so this is from the asylum?
You know, it sounds like it could be so hokey and jokey, but I did not reread it for this discussion, so I'm going back on my memory. But it struck me at the time as taking all of its aspects seriously and sort of asking what would the futuristic implications be of this particular setup. It's definitely a series that I need to personally revisit, but you know, if you find it somewhere online in the cheap bin, I would definitely recommend it. It is Evangeline, not to be confused with Evangeline, which has like a Y and starts with an A. This one starts with an E. Evangeline. This is Chuck Dixon, so you can trust him to tell a good story. So that would be my main recommendation. So we ended up a little obscure, I think, on some of these, and very independent in our independence.
Mission accomplished.
Exactly. But we did also talk about some that are available from the major companies as well, so we did not go, I think, totally obscure. I'm very satisfied. Again, we're not saying that these are underrated comics, necessarily. That's slightly different. We are saying that they are underread and maybe underappreciated.
That these are comics that are absolutely worth a read. They may not be making anybody's best comics of all time lists, but they at least take a couple of spots on our favorites list, and we think that you might like them too.
So if you have any feedback about the comics that we went over here, if you have heard of them, have read them, have some opinions on them, or if you have a personal soapbox of your own of books that you think are criminally underread or underappreciated, we would like to hear that as well. Any and all feedback can be sent to relativelygeeky@gmail.com.
You do realize that you've just opened the floodgates to Jack and Eddie, right? We're going to get like a 12-page email from him.
To be fair, every book that Luke reads is underrated.
Criminally underappreciated, that's true.
So,
you can find our website, which will have this episode, all of our previous episodes, and of course the post that we're talking about with the book bindings, at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can also search for us in iTunes, either by looking for Relatively Geeky Network or The Short Box Showcase.
And as always, with the opinions that are expressed here, remember, we're not experts.
We're just family.
Thanks for listening.
The story of... All of a sudden, I forgot his name because
Ray Palmer.
Thank you, Ray Palmer. Because he goes through it and changes his name to Adam at the end of it. I'm like, oh my gosh, what was your actual name?
That doesn't make any sense.
I know, but
we can see things at 6 inches.
Sorry.
Partly that's for the show, partly for you. So I meant
no. It's not the microscopic. It's not Gemworld. It's 6-inch aliens who travel to Earth and then set up a colony in the jungle. Like the town is like this tall. No, he rides a frog. Frog this big. He's the size of a G.I. Joe. Riding a frog. Okay.
Not every time.
Not every time.
But I think...
But sometimes.
When we're putting ourselves out as experts, especially, that's a good...
Hedge our bets.